We were the first African-American family in that district. I wasn't at the time, but I'm about 6'2", and some folks think I am really scary. Why, I don't know. I'm the kindest person on the planet, but I think some of what students, particularly male, African-American males, face is teachers assume they are something that they may be or may not be, and that assumption oftentimes leads them into directing them more for disciplinary problems than for educational issues. That kind of fits my profile exactly.
Hello, and welcome to the Black and Dyslexic Podcast with Winifred A. Winston and LaDerrick Horn, the show that unapologetically focuses on helping Black and underrepresented minorities navigate the special education process. We want to help raise awareness in the Black and brown community, remove the stigma about learning disabilities, and provide you access to professionals in the space of dyslexia and special education that you need to hear from. Hello, this is Winifred A. Winston along with
LaDerrick Horn.
And we're back. I know I said that before. I just want to say it again. I'm so excited. We just recorded a live episode of the Black and Dyslexic Podcast. And I'm going to let LaDerrick tell you guys all about it because we were in his hometown in New Jersey. And so, LaDerrick, tell the people, what is this episode about?
This is a recording we made. We were requested to do a session, like a panel session, as part of the New Jersey Education Association, NJEA, which is our teachers union in the state of New Jersey, as part of their Transform Conference. I had keynoted an NJEA conference that was their exceptional children's conference dedicated to issues around special education, supporting students with disabilities. And as part of that keynote, I mentioned as a resource for people to check out the Black and Dyslexic Podcast. And just kind of on a whim, I was like, has anybody ever listened to the Black and Dyslexic Podcast? And there was this whole cohort in the room that got real loud. And I got excited. And so I didn't really realize it, but in NJEA, there were people listening to the podcast. And so my contact, Cami, and shout out to Cami for inviting us. She said, yo, could you come through and as part of one of our breakout sessions, do an episode of the podcast? And so as you're getting ready to hear, we were able to put together a panel of both people who have lived the experience of having dyslexia, of having ADHD, experts in the field, educators. And we had this, we had a great audience. Did we have a great audience?
Yes, we had a great audience.
And I think you'll be able to hear some of the giggling and the amen corner, and you're going to hear this conversation. Now, the conversation actually ran for about 2 hours. So what we're doing here is we're going to break it up into two episodes, and you're getting ready to hear the first recording, where we're just going to jump right into the conversation. And the structure of it is that we talk a little bit about the podcast to begin. Then we go into facilitated questions that Winifred and I pose to our panel. And then we're going to end this whole thing up with questions from the audience.
Yeah, you know what? Just get ready, because we've got a standout high school student in this episode that I'm super excited about. And I need the parents. I need the educators. I need folks with lived experience. I need parents to grab your children. This is an episode that they need to hear, because we've got a rock star high school student that is sharing her lived experience.
All right. Without further ado, I don't know.
You okay. Know what? Let's go.
All right. Enjoy the episode.
Thank you so much for coming to our session. I'm LaDerrick Horn.
And I'm Winifred A. Winston.
And we were just giggling because Winifred and I met each other at the International Dyslexia Association's conference in
2019.
And after that meeting, we have collaborated on different projects. As part of that collaboration, we created the Black and Dyslexic Podcast. And this is really Winifred's project, and she'll talk a bit about that. But what stood out to us yesterday, that this is the first time since we first met that we've been in the same room together.
Really? Zoom will have you thinking that you met someone in person.
So this is a great opportunity. Like, we appreciate being able to connect again. We appreciate it being at this conference, and for being a part of the chorus of empowering messages and speakers and sessions that are a part of this event. And to add to that, we were able to put together what we think is going to be a really dynamic panel. Thank you for being at our session too, because we're recording this. And if you have any questions, and the flow of the session is that we're going to say a few words just about the podcast ourselves. We're going to go to our panel. We've got prepared questions that should go for about 60 minutes or so. And then it really goes over to you. If you have any questions of any of us, we'll just go back and forth and kind of be engaged in dialogue. So, Winifred, why don't you kind of get us rolling?
Sure, sure. So I'm the founder and executive director of Dyslexia Advocation, which is a nonprofit that I started. I'm a parent of a child who's dyslexic and ADHD. I'm a former educator. I worked as an administrator for our headquarters first, and then later I went in as a CTE teacher. So I had no teacher prep training. I was an adjunct professor. I worked in higher ed mostly. And when my daughter was identified, I did not know how to help her. I felt lost. I felt confused. I was angry. Like, I'm an educator. I know principals. I can just pick up the phone and call someone. And I still didn't understand that IEP. And so I started doing advocacy work, and I started with an organization called Decoding Dyslexia. And I found out that there were private dyslexia schools and that there was remediation. I fully understood the difference between an intervention and accommodations. But what I also learned was there was no representation. I was often the only Black person going to Annapolis, our state capital, to talk to legislators to get legislation passed. And then I started a support group. And what I found was that Black parents would come to one meeting, then they wouldn't come anymore. But then they would hit me up offline. I have this question. I want to know this. And I'm like, well, why didn't you ask it? I don't know the answer. Like, we were around everybody that knew some of these things. And then the pandemic happened. And I said, you know what? I've got to focus on people that look like me, because now my daughter is in a private school and we're the only Black family. She said, I feel like this is a dark place and the light is shining on me because we're the only African-American family. And so that led to Dyslexia Advocation. I made up the word advocation, advocacy plus education. But what I wanted to do was educate parents and adults and make remediation affordable. We did not qualify for low income, but I could not afford to pay the retainer for an attorney, to pay for the specialized tutoring, and then get an independent educational evaluation all at the same time. So I often say in a matter of 3 days, I was told I needed $22,000 in order to help my daughter learn to read. Now, you guys are educators. What I didn't know is that that evaluation that the school did was sufficient. Although they told me SLD, but I didn't understand. That was sufficient, but I didn't know that. So a big part of the nonprofit is to educate parents and adults, but then also help set off the cost of advocacy, tutoring, and evaluations. The way the podcast came to fruition, I started a hashtag on Instagram, hashtag Black and Dyslexic, because I didn't see any Black folks that were dyslexic. And I started showcasing athletes, because I was a former athlete. Celebrities. But I'm thinking everybody can't identify with a celebrity or professional athlete. So I was a magnet for dyslexics. They were coming out of the woodwork. The firefighter, who's a good friend of mine. I'm like, how all this time I didn't know you were dyslexic? Like the principal. And I started showcasing everyday dyslexics. And kids were DMing me on Instagram. Oh my gosh, they look like me. I didn't know they were dyslexic too. And a mentor in the space, she's like, don't stop using that hashtag. Everybody knows you by that. Wrap it up, get some funding, make it a program, and I don't know, start a podcast. I was like, okay, okay. And so we got some funding from Morgan State University and their Morgan Cares. And one of my board members was like, isn't LaDerek on the advisory committee? I think he's a poet. He would be great. You can't do it all by yourself. Ask him to be the host with you. I'm like, okay, I'll do it. I wrapped it up, got some funding, and we started the Black and Dyslexic podcast with the intention to educate parents, but it became something so much more. So that's how we got started with the nonprofit and then the podcast.
We'll talk about the segments and how we
break. Sure, sure. So because it started with parents, we have a badass parent segment. Right.
And I was last night I was saying that when I talk about this badass parents segment, I always thought bad meant Black and dyslexic.
I never.
But you were just saying just badass, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it makes sense now. And the reason why I did, nobody believed in that segment. Like my board was looking at me sideways. LaDark was like, okay. I'm like, no, this is it. Because as a parent, you feel so alone.
Yeah. Right.
You feel so alone in the fight. Even your family members, they would tell me, oh, my daughter is Logan. Oh, Logan is smart. Like, what are you talking about? I'm like, yeah, that's why I'm concerned. She's not reading. Oh, you're being over the top. She's your only child. Oh, there's nothing wrong with her. You know, family don't support you. You don't feel like you can talk. And culturally, as Black people, we don't talk about mental health or learning disabilities. And so I said, we need a badass parent segment because I would take phone calls on my personal cell phone from parents. Just if they want to cry, if they want to vent. So I was like, no, we have to have a badass parent segment where a parent just tells their journey. And then we have an everyday dyslexic, whether it be an adult or a child, just someone who has dyslexia, who's telling their journey, whether it's positive or it's been very challenging. And then the other two segments are open to professionals in the space, an advocate, a speech and language pathologist, an attorney.
Literacy experts.
Literacy experts, because these are people that I didn't know existed. Right. And I worked in education, right? And before my daughter was identified, this was so illegal, I took the IEP binder home, okay? And called one of my friends and I said, okay, how am I supposed to do this? I'm not gonna lie. I said, well, do I stand beside him and read it? Yeah. I said, well, what do I do? Okay, when I give the test, do I give them like less questions? Like, what do I do? I had no idea, right? I had no idea. So I said, okay, I was an educator. I worked in the school district and I didn't know that these people existed. And so I said, we're going to have folks talk and have unfiltered conversations around Black and dyslexia because it's different. And it was different for me. And I knew people. And so that's when I came up with, okay, that's how we're going to frame it. And the badass parent segment is our most popular listen segment. Like people will come up to me and be like, oh my God, that parent really resonated with me. I feel the same way that she did. And I'm like, see, y'all ain't believing it, but see that neurodivergent mind of mine.
Aren't you glad you called my agent? See, it all works out. It all works out. So I'm LaDark Horn and I come to this work not as a parent advocate, or as an educator, but as a person with a learning disability. And I think some of you, I keynoted the Exceptional Children's Conference last.
Yeah. I'm in tears.
Oh, okay. All right. We gotta make sure she got that on the mic. Okay. Well, yeah, I did the keynote last year at the Exceptional Children's Conference. So I shared a bit of my story then, but I am here from New Jersey, and actually you guys are in my hometown right now. I grew up in Franklin Township. And also from Franklin?
Live in Franklin.
Live in Franklin. Okay. All right. Blue and gold. Okay. But I was first recognized as having a learning disability when I was 9 years old in the third grade. And actually the first label I was given was that I was neurologically impaired. Mm-hmm. That landed me in a resource room, which was a teacher's storage closet. Mm-hmm. After that, self-contained special education classroom. Was very fortunate that my first special ed teacher was an amazing educator. Both her and my paraprofessional, it was clear. So we were in a classroom at the end of the hall. I remember feeling dumb and stupid and what have you. But I also, from that time, I remember that those women loved each and every one of us. Mm. And their expectations for who we were and where we would go in the future was very high. And so get through middle school, high school, still on an IEP. I'm clearly showing signs of having mental health issues, wrestling with depression and anxiety. Ended up having a bit of a breakdown when I was in my junior year of high school and used it as an opportunity to redefine who I was. Had this crazy idea I was going to go to college. And my IEP team recommended I go to Middlesex County College, where I was a part of a support program called Project Connections. And that program was designed to support students with learning disabilities and ADHD, and it changed my life. Mm. I started using accommodations for the first time. And I think two of the things that were made like a major difference beyond getting support, like extra time and what have you, was one, getting an understanding about what my learning disability was, learning about what it was to be dyslexic. I came from both a family and a larger community and a school that was sort of dominated by a culture of silence around disability, where we really didn't talk about it. It was, you know, like if we said anything, it was like you were special, but we didn't really go into depth about what these challenges were. So I think I was also, as an 18-year-old in college, I was also just hungry for these sort of conversations. And then the other thing that I think was so profound is that it was the first time that I really got connected to like a community of people who had challenges like mine, right? So I'd been in spaces with people, but not had community. And so, yeah, so it took me 5 years to get out of county college. I go to New Jersey City University. I ended up getting a BA in mathematics, minored in fine art. Got recruited by the New Jersey Department of Education's Office of Special Education, like my last semester of college. And they asked me to take part in these student leadership conferences we do every spring called Dare to Dream. And so I started doing that work. I don't know if anyone's ever been to the Dare to Dream conferences, but they're phenomenal. So I was there, MC, keynote speaker. And from that, started connecting with organizations all over the United States. I used to work with an organization called NASD, the National Association of State Directors of Special Ed. Was on the board of a number of nonprofits. And now I sit as the board chair for the New Jersey Coalition for Inclusive Education. My company also last year was awarded a 2-year grant from the New Jersey Council on Developmental Disabilities, specifically around doing work to increase access to information to Black New Jersey residents with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And so, yeah, so disability and trying to make the world a better place for people with disabilities has been my world. And I think Winifred and I were probably in a very similar space in 2020, looking at the lynching of George Floyd, you know, looking at the murder of these Black people, and then also seeing our community and other communities rising up asking for justice. And it was a sobering moment for me because I'm at home, like all the rest of us, you know, during the pandemic and asking myself these big questions. And one of them is, what is my work really doing to help Black people? And so, you know, Winifred calls. She called me directly this time, not through my agent. And, you know, she said, we want to, you know, like, you know, my organization, we want to do a podcast. Would you be interested in doing it? And it was both that and then also this grant from the New Jersey Council on Developmental Disabilities. I've described them both as almost like being answers to a prayer that I put out into the world. And so, you know, with the first season of the podcast is up. And I know for me, I learned a lot doing the podcast, right? My work very much comes from this line of, because I didn't have the advantage of a structured literacy program when I was a student, right? I got to college and was reading on a fifth or sixth grade level. So it was audiobooks, it was extra time on tests, it was those sort of things that I could leverage so that I could really apply my intelligence to being able to do work and accomplish the goals that I wanted. But to hear from the literacy experts, to hear from parents who had challenges similar to my mother's, but were also empowered in ways in which my mother could never be, you know, at the time in which she was trying to raise me. And then I think the other thing which has made me very proud of the work that we're doing is, like, I remember for years being in professional settings, people asking about like what books I should read. And I would point them to a book and point them to another book or point them to some curriculum or what have you. And these were always created primarily by white folks and really for white folks. And I mean, and I may even be crying on one of our episodes, but I know I have been in tears and saying like, no, this podcast is what I wish my mother could have had. Yeah. Right. And so, like, one of the things that we've learned is, one is that the format works really well. So it is a spoken word format. It's culturally competent because I don't think we have any white folks that have been on the podcast.
No,
it's just Black folks talking to Black folks.
Yeah.
And it is very much like almost like a conversation in your living room.
Yeah, and it was it was necessary because for me, with all my advocacy, like I said, I was oftentimes the only Black person. And when we met in 2019 in Portland, Oregon, I was hanging out with all my friends and I was having a great time. I went out there by myself. And when George Floyd was murdered and we were asked to put out a statement about it as an organization, what I realized is that some of those friends I was hanging out with, they really weren't my friends. They weren't the allies that I thought they were. And it allowed me, and I had to self-reflect, right? Because I'd gone to PWI, predominantly white institution for undergrad. I was a D1 athlete. So professors would say things like, well, you athletes aren't going to get any special treatment, right at me. Then I went on to a PWI for graduate school. And my first two jobs out of college, I was the only Black person in my role. I had a man, very prominent businessman, tell me, I had a colored girl come perform. And my supervisor looked at me and I'm like, okay. But there was a level of complacency that I had being in those spaces and always being the only Black person.
Yeah.
So when I was doing my advocacy, those Black parents that only came to one meeting, I didn't hear them all the time when they addressed their concerns. I didn't pick up on that they felt inferior. I've always had to be in a white space and be the only Black person. So I didn't see it. And my name is Winifred. I've gone to spaces and when I come in, they're like, oh, you're Winifred. And I know what they were expecting, right? But I just kind of was, it was normal for me. You know, my daughter goes to a private dyslexia school. The first school, we were the only Black family. Her dad is a little uncomfortable. I'm like, oh no, get comfortable with the uncomfortable. We're going here to this event in this really high-end neighborhood. What? Like, I was just conditioned that way. And then when George Floyd happened and I realized it was a hard truth for me, and I said, you know what? I've got to recognize that every Black person, it's not going to be comfortable in that uncomfortable space. And I am going to be okay. Like, we got pushback. I got pushback naming it Black and Dyslexic.
Yeah.
Like, people were coming for me. And I'm like,
oh, the comments are great. The comments are
like,
great.
I was like, yeah. Come on, bring it. You know, yeah. I was an entrepreneur before this. And as a Black person, we go through, do you make your website all Black? Right. Do you want to appeal to everybody? I was one of those people. Oh, we're going to appeal to everybody. We want to help everybody. But what that experience allowed me, the confidence, and basically to like, I don't care. I'm tired of making you feel comfortable. I'm going to feel comfortable. I'm going to make this space comfortable for Black parents to look at the website and say, oh, they look like me. Because that's the first thing we do. When I looked up the staff at the schools I was looking to send my daughter to, I'm looking at the staff
directory. You look at them headshots, right?
Oh man, the custodian, athletic director, admin assistant. That's all you see. There's no Black teachers, right? So naming it Black and Dyslexic, having Black guests on the show, having Black professionals. You know how hard it is when you're trying to find someone that looks like you, that understands culturally what your experience is, when they say you don't have enough books at home, Black parents aren't engaged, right? A lot of the work that I did, because of my professional position, it allowed me the autonomy to take off and go to Annapolis. It allowed me to leave and attend events. But a lot of parents couldn't do that. You know, I post pictures when I'm number one in the carpool line. I'm there at 2:35 and school don't let out to 3:10. I'm one of those parents. But everybody doesn't have that luxury. So naming it Black and Dyslexic and really focusing on the challenges that Black parents face was like healing for me, because I felt like I let my community down, you know, prior to what happened, because I said, I'm in these spaces. I'm seeing these people. And when I went to Portland, the support group, they were like, no, we're going to raise money. We want you to go and get that information and bring it back to us. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like, I have to do this. Mm-hmm. And so what I realized is that so many other people listen to the podcast and say, wow, you answered a question I was afraid to ask.
And that was one of the things in conceptualizing what the podcast would be is that I said to Winifred, I said, you know, like, we're doing this for us, by us. But a lot of white folks are going to listen to this to this program, right? And although that's not the first sort of audience, we were also clear, like, we were going to be this resource. And we get a lot of comments that are folks who are like, I've never been invited into these sort of conversations before, you know? And so, and another thing that we really committed to early on was doing our best to not use teacher talk, right? So educators are utilizing the podcast as a resource, but we try to break down the acronyms, you know, or not use them at all. Right. We understand that language can be a barrier, right, to engage with folks. Mm-hmm. And we've got some of the nation's leading researchers around literacy and dyslexia who have been a part of our conversations. We cite the studies, and I think one of my favorite things about the podcast is that our show notes are like a resource list. So we're capturing every reference that is being made during those conversations, and then providing them as a resource list for people to do their own research. But we're trying to do it in a way which is really engaging.
And I've gotten a lot of feedback from folks that says, I was looking for a podcast on dyslexia, on education. When I started listening, the first 5 minutes, I didn't understand any of the words they used. Mm-hmm. And then when we got to your podcast, it was so conversational. Right. And I said, well, that comes mm-hmm. from me really thinking, like, I was an educator. I taught for 2 years in high school. But again, I was a CTE teacher, right? So I had no formal teacher prep training. I mean, the four classes I was supposed to take for certification, right? The word pedagogy threw me for a loop for a while. I'm like, what? And then what is the other one? Fidelity, right? I was like, what? You know, So I made it, you know, when we interview and we talk to folks, I'm like, could you explain that? But yes. Explain it in like regular,
yes.
Like I'm like regular, break it down so everyone can understand. So I know as educators, you guys will get it. Right? It'll make sense to you, but the parents and the people who are learning, it'll make more sense and it'll be more inviting because the first 5 minutes is not turning them away because it's all these big words and they think they need to do research and be scientists just to really understand it. So that was very, very intentional because as a former educator, I still sat and I would say, womp, 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 womp. They'd be talking. I'm like, what? But I'm also nodding my head and saying yes. And then afterwards, I'm in my car crying. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, in bringing that conversational dynamic to the podcast, we're recording this episode and we've assembled, I think it was going to be an awesome panel. So we were all just like, before y'all came in here, getting to know each other. And the dynamic is really good. I hope we don't get quiet because the mics are on now. But we got a great group here. So we do have prepared questions. We're going to try to get through all of them. We want to give everyone just the freedom that if someone says something that's interesting, you can play off it and we'll just kind of see where the conversation goes. So the first question is just real simple. Just what is your name? Please just like introduce yourself to the audience. So what's your name, your profession, and then your connection to dyslexia and ADHD. And what I love is if Frank could start at the end and if we can work our way back.
Sure. So my name is Frank Latham and I work for the New Jersey Council on Developmental Disabilities. I am a licensed social worker. What I do for the council is I am their advocacy coordinator and their principal presenter. So I go out and do presentations at school and any other place that folks ask me. So I have, that's my professional connection. My personal connection is I'm probably older than everybody on the panel. So part of my connection is I was diagnosed with dyslexia pretty late in my academic career and struggled because so much changed so quickly. We were having a conversation prior to you guys coming in about how improve things have gotten and how much further we still have to go simply because there are technologies and other benefits that I believe have changed the landscape of individuals with disabilities more broadly. But we are not there yet. And I think a panel like this gives us a great opportunity to both learn, hear from folks who have lived experience and allow that lived experience to inform how we move forward.
So. My name is Shay Brown, originally from Harlem, New York. I live in Patterson right now. I am a special educator. I teach resource. When you say resource, it just hit home. I teach resource for kindergarten, second grade, and third grade. I currently teach in Prospect Park, but I was teaching in Patterson for 7 years as special education as resource. I'm also a mother of two. I have a daughter and a son, and my son is 9 years old. He has autism. And this hits home. I'm looking at my bag, see if I need some tissue, because just listening to you two talk, it just brings up a mirage of emotions, just reflecting on my own experiences as an educator and as a mom. And I just have to add, you know, teaching in a community where it's predominantly, you know, minority children, Black and brown, when the topic of dyslexia comes up, and I remember calling into my board meeting 2 years ago because one of the state requirements is we have to do this 2-hour training on dyslexia. And I had a lot of students that I suspected had dyslexia. And when I asked for testing, I was told, exact words were, we do not test for dyslexia. We would have, you know, and that was it. Okay, well then, is there somewhere I can recommend for the parents to take the child, you know, out? Because you're required, this child has an IEP, you're required to provide that testing. And I was told, we'll get back to you. I'm no longer in that district. I just left in November, but I know that if I go back, it's going to be the same question. And it's just so concerning that there's no emergent response to, we need to get this done. And I know I'm not the only one asking the question, but I feel like there's not enough people asking the questions, because we also have a lot of families who are just not informed.
Right.
And I feel like it's my charge, because I am a parent of a child with special abilities, that I need to also inform those parents. So I just feel like that's what I'm supposed to do, not just be in the classroom, but take it further, because there's a stigma in our communities. It, just this morning, I was thinking how even when I was younger, when you think about special education, you think of the little yellow bus.
That's it.
And
we used to call it the cheese box when I was riding on that little yellow bus.
Right. Yes. And the thing is, my son takes that little yellow bus to school and home. And even to this day, I've had parents who refuse to sign off on consent for their child to get supportive services because, and these are their words, I'm not putting my child on that bus.
Right.
And even when I try to talk to them on the side and, you know, express, listen, I'm a mom, you know, I'm just going to talk to you. I'm not talking to you as a teacher. And it's still that fear, that guilt, he'll be fine. You know, we're just going to work with him.
Special education, I always tell them, it's not a place, it's a service.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So I just try to drill that. It's not a place. And I'm up in age where they were just all in that room.
Yes.
Right. And it was a place. Yes. But I try to really say it's a service.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And you guys also hit on something that I wrote down, language. Even when I first started dealing with my children and trying to get early intervention services, the language is so foreign to me. Yeah. And I'm just like, what are you talking about? And I'm a special educator. So me even going in as a parent, they're saying a lot of things that I still didn't understand. And I think we have to break that mold and have that conversation, just like when Lizande, one of the staff of PD2 at NJEA, when she approached me about this, I looked you guys up. And I'm like, why didn't I know about this? It hurt, because I'm just listening. I'm like, oh, this is what I need to spread out. So I'm texting it to all my friends. And they're like, where did this come from? So this is just like mind blowing. And I thank you both. For
you on the show now.
I know. thank you. Here.
Wow.
Amazing.
Awesome. Carmen.
So my name is Carmen Porter, and I am from Salem County. I have worked in education for the last 14 years. I started off as a fifth grade teacher. Then I moved into a CTE setting and work with special ed students, getting them to introductory to the CTE environment and see what they would be interested in. And then I just actually made a change and moved to a different district. And I am now a learning disability teacher consultant. I try to watch my language as well, because I'm always like, I'm an LDTC. And they're like, what's LDTC? Because it's so different in different states. Mm-hmm. So I try to make sure that I explain what that is and say the name. Sometimes I slip and say the LDTC. But so what a learning disability teacher consultant does is we do the learning test that Winifred was talking about that she had done for her daughter. And we look at the different academic strengths and weaknesses that a student has to see if they qualify for services. That is what I do. And my interaction is I don't have anyone as a child for teaching students who have been in my classroom, and also case managing students now that I come in contact with. As I'm doing the testing, I can see, and again, even though we don't test for dyslexia, when you're doing the test, you can see their strengths and weaknesses of where they struggle in reading, where they struggle in writing, and see areas that you can help students in. So one of the reasons I got into education was because when I was in high school, I was a, I'd say, average student. I struggled in some areas, but my guidance counselor had a conversation with my mom and told my guidance counselor told my mom, yes, she should not go to college because she's not college material. Mm. So, and I was sitting there with my mom. So I'm like, how do you tell someone they're not college material? So I went ahead and went to college. I have my master's in special ed. Plus, again, I have my certification now for LDTC. And I actually saw my guidance counselor maybe a few years after I graduated. I actually went to and got my associates as in a community college. And I saw her and she's like, oh, what are you doing? I said, well, I just graduated from community college and about to go to my 4-year college. And she was like, oh, that's nice. And I was like, yeah.
You know, when you said they don't test for dyslexia, I tell parents, but they can identify characteristics of dyslexia.
Correct.
And it's all about how you say things.
Yeah.
Correct. Right? I didn't know that. Because they identified characteristics of dyslexia for my daughter to put SLD on there.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So now let's go from there.
Yes.
So it's all about that language and how you say it, right? You can identify characteristics of dyslexia. So yeah.
Desiree?
Well, hi. My name is Desiree Graham. I'm a high school student at PHS.
Got to say what PHS is.
Sorry. Piscataway High School. I'm going to go to Middlesex College, and I want to be a special education teacher. I have ADHD and dyslexia. I was diagnosed at a young age, grades 5th or 4th. I stood back in kindergarten because of my dyslexia. This was before I knew I had it. It just, like, took a toll on me.
All right. So Desiree is a part of a program that I'm doing in Piscataway High School called EPIC. And she has been one of the most outspoken people about having ADHD. And when I heard she wanted to be a special education teacher one day, I said, you know, I'd love to have your voice to be a part of this conversation. So can we all applaud and welcome our friend?
Okay, so what are some common challenges faced by Black neurodivergent students in the education system, and what have you seen that has helped them to overcome these challenges?
Just anybody can take a shot at it. We'll just kind of go back.
So I'll start because part of it is the time frame. So I was sharing with the panel earlier, my father was in the military. We moved a lot. When I finally landed at the school that I graduated high school from, we were the first African-American family in that district. I wasn't at the time, but I'm about 6'2", and some folks think I am really scary. Why, I don't know. I'm the kindest person on the planet, but I think some of what students, particularly African-American males, face is teachers assume they are something that they may be or may not be. And that assumption oftentimes leads them into directing them more for disciplinary problems than for educational issues. That kind of fits my profile exactly. I was a big, I guess, scary kind of a guy who showed out from a disciplinary standpoint because I was, more than anything else, frustrated because I wasn't getting the educational resources. And again, my mom was a social worker. My dad was in the military. We had plenty of economic resources. It was more about not having the opportunity or being evaluated properly than it was anything my parents lacked or didn't try to accomplish. It was, in my opinion, an assumption on the school's part about who I was before they knew who I was, and the systems that were in place that really don't look individually at the students and say, here's somebody who needs some kind of support, what kind of support we can we provide for them?
Yeah, and so that's really speaking the biases.
Yeah, right? Like absolutely.
Some of the biases. Have you seen any programs, or has anybody seen any programs that really help to address those biases?
You know, I think one of the things that significantly improves upon those biases is calling them what they are. Mm-hmm. Like if folks know, then the level of awareness is raised in a way that all of the sudden, when somebody sees that, it's not a family saying, we feel our son or daughter isn't being treated fairly, but it becomes more system-wide and folks can more appropriately identify and hopefully move to correct that. So I think programs like this do a great job of, for lack of a better term, exposing the truth. Yeah. Mm.
Anybody else, any other challenges that you've seen?
Growing up and being in middle school with these disabilities has been a little hard for me, and finding the support that I needed from my teachers. I just wanted to say, I didn't really have that much support in middle school for my ADHD. Because like a way that would help me focus on like my work and stay on task would be sitting on the ground. But my one teacher, she just would not understand that me sitting on the ground is helping me and helping me focus. She would make me sit in a desk and just sit there and try to do my work when I couldn't. So I would just sit on the ground anyway and like try to do my best. And if I got yelled at, it was what it was because I was doing my work.
I'm going to speak, I know as an educator, especially as a woman of color, growing up, I'm 48 years old. So when I was young, my mom had a relationship with my teachers. Mm-hmm. I saw that, you know, would call my mother if I was acting up in school. I even had one teacher, Mrs. Altagracia, who I still love to this day, who she knew my mother was a single mother, raising two children with three jobs. My mother had three jobs, working at Macy's, the bank, and I forgot what the third one was. And my mother was an immigrant. She came from Jamaica. So she was doing a lot on her own. And I had one teacher who even on the weekend, she would take me with her son out. I remember we went, that was the first time I saw the tree in Rockefeller Center. Mm. So there was a real relationship. When I decided to become an educator, I wanted that type of relationship with my families. Mm-hmm. So one thing I think that's really important in the education system, and it's a lost art to me, a lot of teachers don't take the time to have relationships with the parents of their students. And I think especially when you're talking about within the special education field, you have to have a relationship with the families. You cannot just teach in the classroom and expect that child to go home and everything's going to continue. I'm a firm believer in teaching the whole child, and that whole child includes the family. Mm-hmm. So when I first meet my students for the year, I send home a letter with all my information. I give them my cell phone number. I have Class Dojo, which I love. I also give them my email. They can reach me anytime. I'm on the phone 9 o'clock at night sometimes with some of my parents because they're so frustrated. I'm Ms. Brown. I'm trying to help them with the homework. I don't know. And I'm like, you have to, I know it's hard, but you got to pace yourself. The same way she's struggling. You got to understand her processing is a little different. And just to have those conversations with them, it helps the child because you're working across settings. You're not just working in the classroom. You're also working within their home environment. And I think that allows for a more successful experience for that child, especially when they're dealing also with behaviors, because I have children who have, you know, multiple labels, you know, dyslexic, ADHD, you know, they want to throw out everything on the IEP. And a lot of times you have educators who just look at the IEP and that's it. They're not looking at the child. They're not looking at the mother. They're not looking at the father. And the thing is, when you have those relationships with the families, you start to learn about a lot of stuff that's going on that's affecting that child. Mm-hmm. So being able to do that, and I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but I have a lot of parents who say, I've never had a teacher like you, who actually cares. You know, even during the pandemic, we were virtual, which was one of the hardest teaching times of my life. And I know everybody in here can relate to that. I was sending my kids rewards, you know, because they were doing so well. And, you know,
like through the mail?
Yes, yeah. Through the mail. I was literally sending them rewards through the mail because they were doing, you know, so successful. Especially during the wintertime, I was sending them hats and gloves because I knew we got to really see in the homes. I might be talking to you, but I didn't, you know, to be able to see what's going on in the home, I saw a couple of needs that were going on. And you just saw the building of those relationships have given me lasting relationships with my students who I no longer teach, but those parents still reach out to me. And, you know, there's also situations where there were younger siblings where I may have seen, you know, there might have been some challenges. And because I built that relationship, those parents trusted me when I said, I need you to call the department, set up an appointment to get some testing done, because the earlier you get this done,
the better successful that child will be, you know? So you're giving him or her an opportunity to be at level with his peers eventually. So let's get that early intervention. And I'm a huge advocate for that. So I think the biggest thing to start with is that communication, mm-hmm. building a bond, building a relationship with the families, because that also reduces, I hate that word, that stigma that's in our communities, especially the Black and Brown community. And the language is key. You know, I live in Patterson, and we have a lot of Hispanic families. And I've had students of our, you know, Hispanic families who don't speak English. So they come to these meetings, even though there's a translator, they're still lost. And they're just signing off. Yeah. And then eventually they don't even know that a lot of these services that their child is entitled to, that IEP is a legal document, they're not even aware that their child is missing these services because we're having a teacher shortage. There's just so, and they don't even know their rights. They don't know what the prize book is, the parents' rights instruction, you know, a booklet to show you what to do. So it's just, again, it's having that relationship, talking with the parents, talking with those families, and getting to know that child fully so that, you know, everybody can be successful moving forward.
I definitely do agree with everything you're saying because, mm-hmm. like, for it to work for a child that has disabilities, it has, like, and for the teachers and the parents, everybody has to have communication. Because without it, then, like, somebody is missing some important part of what's going on. And I do really appreciate all the teachers that put in the time and effort trying to get to know their students.
Desiree, we were prepping for this earlier, and she was saying how, like, you were saying, like, that's one of the major differences for you now in high school, right?
Yes.
And I'm a big Desiree up. I love all these panelists. But we were all getting to know each other, and Justin, who's recording us now, said, you know, some of your expertise besides just being who you are and showing up as your full self in this space is that no one else on this panel has grown up with social media.
Yeah. Mm. Yes, yes.
Which is a big, that's a big
one. All right. It's true. You know, there are some things that, like, you know, again, that you bring to this. And thank you for being here. No Carmen, do you have anything?
I was going to add just the fact of labeling a student lazy or uninterested. Mm. Here we go. Because of the fact that child might not be lazy and uninterested. Maybe they just don't understand what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Did you, as a teacher, check in with that student to see maybe they're struggling and don't know how to tell you? Again, it kind of connects both of you two's conversations where you got to get to know that student to understand what they're struggling with. If you don't understand their struggles, then you can't help that child. And if you can't help that child, it's going to turn into a discipline issue because they're going to just shut you out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to turn into the, oh, you're not listening to me? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, how about you go to the office or how about you go here? Mm-hmm. Instead of finding the right solution for that student.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to chime in because what all of you said, when you said you were identified in fourth and fifth grade, that's late.
Yes. Yeah.
That's not early, that's late. And most Black and Brown children are identified late. Yeah. And it's very hard to catch up. When you talk about sitting on the floor, as a parent, when I saw my daughter doing virtual tutoring, she was like this. She was moving a lot. And I'm 48 too. And I went to private school and you sat just like that. Now, back then I didn't know it, but you guys can probably tell I'm ADHD. But I was thinking, like, you need to be sitting still. No, my daughter likes to move. And when I saw her moving and the educators explained to me, no, she's focused, she's learning. And then I said, well, gosh, that's why I'm probably doing so well on this ball chair. But I didn't know I was neurodivergent. And so early identification for Black and Brown kids is so important. Yes. And culturally, we don't empower them with that identification. Right. My daughter is 13 now. From the time we got identified, I told her that she had dyslexia. She now tells me back then she thought it was an illness. Mm-hmm. Right. She thought it was an illness. And I told her her brain works differently. And then she was enrolled in a private dyslexia school. So she's like, I'm like, oh, Octavia Spencer is dyslexic. She was like, I see them every day, Mom. I go to school with a whole bunch of dyslexics, right? It's like nothing to her now. But she was able to self-advocate in school. A teacher kept skipping over her. And I said to her, she says, well, Mommy, she keeps skipping over me. And I said, well, she's trying to get to know you as a learner. you're new here. She's trying to get to know you. She doesn't want to embarrass you. She doesn't want you to be uncomfortable. I said, let's go through the first trimester. If it still continues, I'll say something. She walked away, and then she came back. She said, well, mommy, I have to tell you something. I said, what? She said, I told her I'm here now. And I learned by being challenged. And if you would just be patient with me, I can get you the answer. Okay. 8 years old, little black girl at a predominantly white school. But I will tell you, we had problems with that educator ever since. But she was able to self-advocate in third grade. Right? And that's a huge, huge difference.
All right, y'all. So we're going to break there. That's going to be the end of this episode. We're ending with that amazing story about Logan, Winifred's daughter, advocating for herself, saying, I'm here now. And that that powerful example of advocacy. I know I certainly could not speak up for myself when I was that age. But we're really excited to be able to share with y'all part two. So Winifred, why don't you close us out?
All righty. Well, there you have it. Another episode of the Black and Dyslexic Podcast. We were on location at NJEA's Transform Conference in Somerset, New Jersey. So hold tight. We got part two for you. You're going to hear from our panelists and also the audience with a wonderful Q&A.
Tune in next week, where we'll continue to bring you lived experiences and more unfiltered conversations with experts in the field around all things Black and Dyslexic. Make sure you subscribe and follow the Black and Dyslexic Podcast, where we educate, empower, and equip Black and underrepresented minorities. The Black and Dyslexic Podcast is partially funded by Morgan Cares and the Center for Urban Health Disparities Research and Innovation, awarded by the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. The Black and Dyslexic Podcast is sponsored by Dyslexia Advocation Incorporated, a 501c3 charitable organization located in Baltimore City, Maryland, whose mission is to equip parents of children with dyslexia and other language-based learning disabilities with the necessary tools to help their children become successful readers. You can find them on the web at www.soallcanread.org.